the Hebrew words that start this psalm are the words Yahweh Adonai, which are both names for God. They're both Hebrew words that are names for God, some of the most common names for God. Yahweh coming from the Hebrew word with roots to it, which mean I am. When God introduced himself to Moses, when he said, Moses, I want you to go and free my people from Egypt. And Moses said, well, who am I supposed to tell them told me to come? And God says, I am who I am. That is my name. And so as that name got worked over history, it became Yahweh is the Hebrew word for that. Adonai is a word that indicates that God is the one in charge, that God is the one who rules, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the Master. And so when it's translated into English, into our English translations, O Lord, our Sovereign, those sound more descriptive, but in fact, in the Hebrew, it's the names of God. So we're starting right off that this psalm is a psalm that is directed not to us about God, but is a psalm that is just pure praise to God. And so it starts by saying, I might start a conversation and say, Heidi, and start a conversation. And this psalm starts a conversation by saying, Yahweh, Adonai, two of these great words that can only just begin to capture the essence of who God is as a name, as especially in scripture, the names often are capturing the essence of who the person named is. And we can't possibly encapsulate all of God into a name, but these names, Yahweh, Adonai, those are the words that remind us this is who we're speaking to, this God who can't even be named, this God who was from the very beginning, from before the beginning, this God who is the Lord and ruler over all things, not just all people and all nations, but all of creation itself. That's who this psalm is directed toward. And it goes on, Yahweh Adonai, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. Now imagine with me, if you will, not living in Toronto, and living somewhere where you can see stars in the night sky. Did any of you grow up in this city? Okay, a couple of you grew up. There are these things at night that twinkle in the sky. They're lights. They're called stars. If you grew up in the city, you can't see them. And it was one of the weirdest things when I moved here and I realized it never gets dark in this city. Because there's so much light, they call it light pollution, but it's always a little bit too light to be able to see the night sky. So sometimes we need to go out into the country and we need to go where there aren't so many lights so that we can see the expanse of the sky above us. Because when we get out of the city, when we get out of all of the light pollution around us, it's the most extraordinary thing. You're lying there. I remember one summer I was working at a camp in Brandon, Manitoba. Well, it wasn't even in. It was about 45 minutes outside of Brandon, Manitoba, essentially in the middle of nowhere. And I remember one night in August when there was a meteor shower. And we were spent all night lying on a dirt road, because you could do that because it was 45 minutes outside of Brandon, Manitoba, and there weren't people. So we could lie on this dirt road all night and just stare. And I have never been so overwhelmed by the magnificence of the heavens. It felt like the stars were coming right down to meet you. When they were falling from the sky, these flashes of light, there were times I actually felt myself going, oop, like this, because I thought the star, like, it felt so close, it felt so immersed. It was by far one of the most extraordinary experiences of God's creation I've ever had in my whole life, was that night lying on a dirt road in Manitoba, the middle of nowhere, just surrounded by the night sky. And so that's what I think of when I read this psalm, and it starts, Yahweh Adonai, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. When I was lying there on that dirt road, there's only the only explanation for that extraordinary vision is God. There's no other way to explain how something like that, in my mind, could possibly exist and be overwhelmed. And so I imagine that the psalmist, the person who first started expressing these words to God, that was the kind of thing that they were experiencing. And then they move on and they say, in the NRSV, the Red Bibles, out of the mouths of babes and infants, you have founded a bulwark because of your foes to silence the enemy and the avenger. And then if you're reading an NIV, I don't know, which is another standard translation that we use, it's translated a little bit differently. It says, through the praise of children and infants, you have established a stronghold against your enemies to silence the enemy and the avenger. If you're a King James person, out of the mouths of babes and nursing infants, you have ordained strength because of your enemies, that you may silence the enemy and the avenger. Now, when I was reading in various commentaries on this passage, this verse 2 of Psalm 8 gets a lot of ink to try and explain what is actually being said here. What it comes down to is it's really hard to translate Hebrew. Ancient Hebrew. It's really hard, even for people who spent their entire lives studying ancient Hebrew and trying to translate it. And it's hard for a lot of reasons. And some of the reasons are that the words don't translate literally one to the other, right? If I'm speaking French and I say to you bonjour, I can translate into the English and say that means hello, right? But if I'm translating from a language like ancient Hebrew, it doesn't translate quite that directly. And so the translators have to figure out, well, what is the meaning behind this? What is trying to be said here? And to make sure that they are as faithful as possible to what is being said in the ancient Hebrew, how do we capture that in the English language? And so, and then there's other issues that I don't fully understand, but I trust the people that I'm reading that in ancient Hebrew, they don't have quite the same, the words don't quite have the same understanding of tense. So we have like something happened in the past tense, in the present tense, in the future tense, right? It's pretty clear. And Hebrew doesn't quite work quite that simply. And so there's all sorts of challenges with translating, which is why when you're reading different translations, especially of this verse, they'll read a little bit differently. But let me tell you that they all mean the same thing. And this is what they mean. They mean that we start with the babies, out of the mouths of babes and infants. There is nobody that is more weak, that is more vulnerable than a baby, right? If a baby doesn't have somebody to meet its every single need, it will die. A baby can't even hold its own head up. A baby can't do anything, right? They are completely vulnerable to whatever can happen from the world around it, from people, from anything can get at a baby. They are the ultimate of human frailty and weakness. But when they take So that's what's being symbolized. Poetry is a lot of symbolism, right? So out of the mouths of babes and infants, out of the mouths of the weakest, the frailest, the most humble, those who are the most frail, out of their mouths, and it's referring back to speaking the name, the Adonai, the Yahweh, the name, the majesty of God. When they take the name of God in their mouths, when they acknowledge the sovereignty of God, the majesty of God, the might of God, the bigness of God, when these weakest, most frail, most having no strength of their own whatsoever, declare the name of God, declare who God is, that's where there is great strength. You see, knowing God isn't about our own strength. It's not about our own intelligence going, oh, I'm so smart. That's why I know God is there. That's why I know God loves me. That's why I know who God is. That's not it at all. It's not about saying, I am such an accomplished human being. That's why I know about God. That's why I know who God is, or I know God, or I've experienced God. That doesn't play into it at all. In fact, the Bible tells us over and over and over and over again, the same message that we read here in Psalm 8, that in fact, it is out of the mouths of babes and infants. It is the weakest, the most frail, the most humble who know God the most purely. Why? Because there's nothing of ourselves to get in the way. How many of you made it to the movie night last week? We had a movie that was I can't go into what the whole movie is, but there was one moment where somebody in the movie was telling a story, and they were telling a story about three scientists who went to visit the Dalai Lama, and they went to see him. They were looking for some wisdom, and the Dalai Lama was there, and he was pouring them tea before they started to talk, and he just kept pouring and pouring, and the cup was overflowing, and everything was spilling, and the three scientists trying to be all polite weren't saying anything, until one of them finally went, excuse me,
Dalai Lama, or however you refer to the Dalai Lama, you might want to stop pouring pouring the tea because it's spilling everywhere, right? And the Dalai Lama said to them, you are like this cup. And so I want you to go home before I'm going to say anything to you. Because right now you're like this cup, which is so full of knowledge, there's nothing else I can pour into it. I want you to go home and remember what you don't know before I can ever speak to you. And that story really, really struck me because I thought, it's like that with God, isn't it? As long as we are confident in our own strength and our own wisdom, our own intellect, that we know everything there is to know about God, then what can God possibly tell us about himself? Right? It's like pouring that tea into an already full cup where it's just going to spill out the side and be no good to anybody. And that's why the babes and the infants, the weakest, the most frail, who know their cup is empty, right? They know that they don't know what they don't know. That's where then there's room for God to pour in his knowledge and his understanding. And I think that one of the commentators I was reading suggested that the enemies that are being referred to in the psalm, which is just a generic enemies, but suggested that anybody who already has their cup full, anybody who already thinks that they know everything, those are essentially the enemies because they don't have room for God because they're already full up of their own ideas, their own intellect, their own knowledge, all of that. See, because knowing God isn't about our strength. Knowing God isn't about our intelligence. Knowing God is about nothing more than taking the position of being those babes and infants before God. In 1 Corinthians, which is in the New Testament, it's a letter that Paul wrote to a bunch of Christians in the city of Corinth. And he wrote some words that in my own life have been really, really important. And I'm going to read those words for you. If you want to follow, if you just kind of keep a finger in Psalm 8 and flip further by about 500 pages to 926, you can follow along here. It's at 1 Corinthians in the first chapter. And I'm going to read verses 20 to 21 and then jump ahead to 26. And so Paul asks them, where is the one who is wise? Where's the scholar? Where's the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world didn't know God through wisdom, God decided through the foolishness of the proclamation to save those who believe. And then jumping down to verse 26, consider your own call, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were powerful, not many were of noble birth, but God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, things that are not, to abolish things that are, so that no one might boast in the presence of God. It is out of the mouths of babes and infants that God's strength is seen, that God's strength is most experienced. And the psalmist continues, having established, out of the mouths of babes and infants, you've ordained strength because of your enemies, that you may silence the enemy and the avenger. What a great testimony when a person of faith who isn't seen by the world as being super smart or wise or intelligent or strong or any of those kind of things is able to speak incredible truths simply because there's room for God to speak through them because their cup is not already full of their own self. And the psalmist goes on and goes, you know, God, when I look at the heavens, the work of your fingers. Now just think about that. This is very intentional by the poet, I think. The heavens, this vast, vast, vast expanse of the universe, what we can see at night when we're not in the city. The work of your fingers. So think about God as a person, just little fingers. All it took was God's little fingers to make this massive heavens. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers. The moon and the stars that you've established. What are humans that you're mindful of them? Mortals that you care for them? You know, when we look at the vastness of God's creation. It is not weird to think, who am I in the midst of all of that? Have you ever stood in somewhere that really overwhelmed you with its creative beauty? I wonder, like me on that road in outside Brandon, Manitoba, have you ever been somewhere? I've heard tell of people who go to the Grand Canyon, another kind of experience of being overwhelmed by the vastness of it. Is there somewhere you can think of in your own life where you've been, where the beauty, the bigness, the majesty of God's creation leaves you going, who am I in the midst of all of that? I think it's a normal human response, isn't it? That when we see all that God has made, we also kind of become aware of our own smallness, our own insignificance in a lot of ways. And it's possible that that can go, oh, there's no way that a God who made all of this has time for little old me. There's no way that a God who put stars in the sky, put the moon and the sun and trees and all the beasts of the field and the creatures of the sea, there's no way that that God has anything to do with little old me. He's busy with everything else. And yet, this is where the psalmist goes, and this is so true and so important for us to hold on. And yet, you have made them, us, human beings, mortals, a little lower than God. Some of your translations will read a little lower than the angels, and crowned them with glory and honor. You've given them dominion over the works of your hands. You've put all things under their feet. Psalmist says, you know, I'm looking at the expanse of the night sky, and who am I in the midst of all of that? Who are people in the midst of all of that? And yet, God, it's us, it's human beings, it's people that you have set up as just under you, as above all of that. This is very, very in keeping with Genesis, with the way that the world was created that we read about in Genesis 1 and then Genesis 2, that God created all the beasts, all the animals, all of creation, and then he said to the person that he had created, listen, I want you to name them all. I want you to have the word that we use as dominion, but it doesn't mean dominion like you get to do whatever you want with them. It has the sense of stewardship, like I am giving you, human beings, all this magnificence that I've created to take care of, to steward, to use for my glory, because you are the apex of my creation. You are the best, right? God says, I created, after everything he created, oh, and it was good, it was good, it was good. And then God created human beings, and he says, oh, and it was very good, so good. 1 Corinthians again, God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise, the babies and the infants. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong, babies and infants. God chose what is low and despised in the world, things that are not, to abolish the things that are, so that no one might boast in the presence of God. In contrast, God is why you are in Christ Jesus, who became for us wisdom from God and righteousness and sanctification and redemption. If I don't have any strength of my own to refer back to, if I don't have great intelligence and wisdom to refer back to, if I don't have lots of money and lots of things that the world upholds and says, all of these make you great, and all of these make you somebody that I should listen to, and all of these things are the things that give you power and position and prestige in the world. If I don't have any of those, what the world says is, you're the least. You don't matter. I'm not even going to hear you. But God goes, you're exactly who I want, because you I can work through. You I can work with, because you have room for me. Because your cup isn't already full. When I pour into it, it's not all just going to spill over the table. It's the humble. It's the frail. It's the weak. God chose what is foolish in the world. God chose what is weak in the world. God chose what is low and despised in the world. For me in my life, that was great comfort. At one point, it was also a real kick in my pants because I was telling God all the reasons why I shouldn't follow where he was calling me to go. Then he was like, read this. I was like, oh, shoot. I can't say to God, no, you know what? I'm not going to do what you've asked me to do. I'm not going to go where you've asked me to go or be who you've asked me to be because I am not very smart, because I am not very accomplished, because I'm not wise, because I'm not strong, because I'm not good at speaking, or because I'm not this or not that or not the other thing. It's Moses, right? Moses going, God, you're sending me. You said I should go talk to Pharaoh. Who am I to go talk to Pharaoh? Don't you know he wants to take my head? Don't you know that I have a stutter? I can't possibly talk to Pharaoh. And God's like, listen, no worries. I'll take care of all of those things. And perhaps God might have also said, it's not in scripture, but I imagine God going, and in fact, it's because you're all of those things that it's going to be even more incredible what I do for you. Because nobody's ever going to say, oh, look at Moses. Wasn't he fantastic? He did all this stuff. I could never do that because I don't have all that Moses had. Moses didn't have anything to bring to the table. So God says, it's all from me. That's us too. When we feel like we don't have anything to bring, we don't have anything to offer God, it's exactly in that absence that God does his most incredible work. We might look at the world, we might look at what other people are doing and go, oh, who am I compared to that? Yet, God has made you a little lower than God himself, crowned you with glory and honor, given you dominion over the works of God's hands. He's put all things under your feet. It's okay to be overwhelmed by that, intimidated by that. But also, you can't fail. You can't fail when it's all God doing it all. In a moment, we're going to come to this communion table, which is the ultimate symbol of God doing it all, right? When we go into our lament time, we're very aware of sin and the havoc that sin wreaks in our own lives, in the world, of the whole creation around us. And yet, God still somehow shines through. God's will is somehow still always done. In the midst of all of that, God saw fit to become a human being, to become Jesus, to deal with sin because we couldn't deal with sin. God saw fit to allow the sin of this world to destroy Jesus. Knowing that even death couldn't stop God doing what he wants to do. I mean, my goodness, we talk about babies and infants being the ultimate of human frailty. Dead people are the ultimate of human frailty. They bring nothing to the table. Even that couldn't stop God from rescuing us, from doing what God intends to do from the beginning, which is have us be with him as his children.